3rd of March 2024 marks the 100-year anniversary of the end of the Khilafah. The decades leading up to the 3rd of March 1924 was a very difficult period for the global leadership of the Muslims, as various European powers were competing with each other over Arabia, North Africa, the Balkans, and the Black Sea. Ever since, we have witnessed new nations spring up across the Muslim world, but the success of these nations have been extremely mixed, and the demand for Islamic rule and governance remains amongst the Muslims, something recognized by successive polls and surveys. Geopolity will be publishing a booklet, 100 Years, 100 Q&A, on the 3rd of March, so please keep an eye out for it. The team here at Geopolity have been working very hard on this. It will cover key questions many have on the Khilafah on this 100-year anniversary. Here to discuss this all is Geopolity founder Adnan Khan. How are you keeping, Adnan?
I'm good, Yusuf. I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Now, many people may look at this podcast topic and ask why this matters from a geopolitical perspective. Something that took place 100 years ago, what bearing does it actually have on global competition and geopolitical struggle today?
Okay, Yusuf, so I think that's probably a good question to begin with, actually. This topic's important. It's important for Muslims. Muslims comprise 2 billion people in the world. That's 25% of global population. And what's happened to this sizable population in the world, where they stand today, how they've got to where they are, is actually very important. And it actually does have implications on global geopolitics. So what happened in 1924? What subsequently happened then? What has evolved? The impact it's had on the Muslims? This actually has an impact on the world. That's why actually having some understanding of this is quite important. Now, the Khilafah in history, why most Muslims still have this demand for the Khilafah today, fact that the majority of Muslims today are not Arab. Arabia was the birthplace of Islam. This is something significant as well. The fact that we have multiple ethnicity, tribes and people who consider themselves one nation, one ummah. This makes it a very important discussion. And really, historically, when the Khilafah was influential, it was because the political system, the Khilafah, was applied, it shaped the world. So that's why if the global ummah, 2 billion people, can overcome the current challenges, it would be a geopolitical game changer. That's why, from that perspective, it's actually a very important discussion.
So why did the Khilafah collapse back in 1924?
So Yusuf, there's actually many reasons that really in the end all culminated and engulfed the Khilafah. If I was to summarize them just to two things, I would say one is internal and one is external. So internally, Yusuf, the Khilafah and the Ummah at large, it lost the ability to apply Islam to practical issues and to everyday life. And this was really over a long period, the neglecting of the Arabic language and then losing the ability to perform ijtihad. All of this, it eventually led the Khilafah to be in a very weak intellectual position. So when we saw the rise of Europe, the Khilafah was really unable to answer a lot of questions and answer what they were bringing. So what this did was it prevented the Khilafah from progressing. And then externally, I would say, Yusuf, when the Industrial Revolution took place, Europe, it basically went on steroids. We find they went into fifth gear. They went and colonized the world. So really from the 17th century, Europe, it came to the Middle East, it came to the Muslim world. It began to meddle in the affairs of the Muslim world. The Europeans supported multiple armed movements against the Khilafah. And in this time period, you saw the emergence of many of the countries today, the tribal leader, the Sauds, the Hashemites, and they rose up against the Khilafah in the end. So the Khilafah really, over a period of time, it just became engulfed by internal and external problems, which eventually led to the collapse of the Khilafah in Turkey.
Now, this obviously sent shockwaves across the Muslim world. What impact did it have?
So it had a major impact, Yusuf, and a lot of this we're still really faced today. So the Middle East that we have today, which consists of, what, about 20 countries, these states emerged that never existed prior to that. We saw the emergence of nationalism in Turkey, across Arabia, which really a lot of the problems that has created are still with us today. We saw the emergence of what I would call lackey leaders. So if you look at the Gulf leaders, if you look at many of the leaders that emerged, they emerged as well. a lot of this eventually led to the establishment of the Zionist entity Israel. How is it possible for a foreign entity to have emerged amongst the Muslims? This was because the Muslims had declined, and this is one of the factors that emerged. We see in South Asia a huge movement, the Khilafat movement, emerged in order to try and defend and protect the Khilafah as well. Eventually, we saw the establishment of a state in South Asia in the name of Islam, Pakistan, that is. On the other flip side, Yusuf, we see the emergence of numerous problems, economic, social, governance, and these have really only got worse. So without centralized leadership, what we find is the problems the Muslim world have, a lot of them are still with us today, and they've really ballooned into multiple other issues.
Do you think there's still a public opinion for the Khilafah in the Muslim world?
Of successive surveys, polls, research over the last few decades all show one thing, that there's a huge demand for Islam to play a major role in governance, state or society. And the sheer breadth of research on this is actually very, very broad. So whilst the Muslim world has many problems, they've embraced nationalism, what you find though, Yusuf, when we look at Syria, when we look at Palestine, when we look at the Uyghur Muslims, when we look at caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, you see the sentiment of the Muslims across borders is the same. It's in line with Islam. So all of this indicates that there are still many Islamic sentiments. The Muslims have many positions which contradict nation states. So this shows you that there is still a demand when it comes to identity of Muslims. There's still a major reference to Islam. And there's still a demand that Islamic governance should play a major role in state or society today. So all of these indicate that there is still a demand for the Khilafah. Although, yes, I would caveat that there are a lot of problems that Ummah face. There's a lot of problems into how they see the future. But Muslims still feel Islam should play a major role in whatever that future is.
We can't really discuss the Khilafah without a discussion on the governance models that exist. So, for example, Turkey, Pakistan and Afghanistan, they would argue that they have some form of Islamic governance and so there's no need for the Khilafah. What do you say about that?
So, Yusuf, since the end of the Khilafah in 1924, we've seen various regimes and nations emerge who claim that they are implementing Islam, that they are maybe even the Khilafah, that they are the modern form of what Islam requires in terms of politics. And we've had many. And many have disappeared over time as well. So you're right, the countries you mentioned are probably some key ones. So Turkey, for example, Erdogan, he's viewed as the Mujaddid, the reformer. We see in his rhetoric, there's a lot of Islam. We see on Palestine, he talks about Palestine, he talks about defending them, which is a separate territory, separate country. So he's trying to argue that this is an Islamic position. But what you find, Yusuf, with Erdogan and many of our rulers is there's a lot of rhetoric which is based in Islam, but it doesn't really go beyond that. So it's difficult to argue Erdogan's foreign policy is Islamic, because what you find is when it comes to Palestine, Erdogan has some Islamic positions. But when it comes to other issues, it's really Turkish national interest. So if you look at the Balkans, if you look at China, if you look at the relationship Turkey has with Russia. So what you find, Yusuf, is Erdogan picks and chooses Islam. He picks and chooses which parts of Islam to apply. So that's not really an Islamic form of governance where you pick and choose. And you find that's a common problem. If you look at Pakistan, Pakistan was created in the name of Islam. People migrated and sacrificed a lot to get to Pakistan. But again, what you find since then, apart from some laws which are based upon Islam, some family laws, what you find really is there's very little Islam in most parts of Pakistan's policy. So you look at domestic, you look at the economy, you look at foreign policy. There's actually very little reference to Islam. And what this really shows us is, again, a lot of rhetoric. But when it comes to practical implementation, there's very little Islam. If we look at Afghanistan, the Taliban, they've been in power twice now. And they are actually very open that they don't actually believe in the Khilafah as an Islamic form of governance. They believe in the Imarat system, which is effectively a system where your judiciary implements Sharia within its borders. So, for example, their foreign policy isn't really based upon Islam. So what this really shows you, Yusuf, is because the sentiments of the Ummah are still very Islamic, many rulers and regimes feel that they have to pay service to them. So what they do is they implement some Islam, But what you find is generally they're quite nationalistic, and on key issues, really it's national interests rather than Islam. And that's not what the Khilafah is. Khilafah isn't you just implement a few rules here and there to do with prayer and personal etiquette. What you find is the Islamic Khilafah system, which is based upon Islam, has many detailed rules when it comes to governance, foreign policy, social system, economy. So to be a Khilafah, you've got to implement all of it. You can't really pick and choose, and that's what these countries do.
Now, these countries have generally been accepted into the global community, but there has also been a darker side of this Islamic governance side of things. So ISIS, many considered them to have been an Islamic state and had established the Khilafah. What do you make of that?
So it's interesting, Yusuf. It's really the West who view ISIS as a Khilafah. They insist on calling it the so-called Islamic State. I'm not sure why you would use that terminology. Either it is or it isn't. But what you find, the Muslims, Ummah, globally were actually very united on ISIS, that they weren't the Khilafah. They didn't represent Islam. So you find that whilst there may be divisions amongst the Ummah when it comes to many other aspects of Islam, on this one, they were actually united. And I think, Yusuf, if you just have a brief look at how ISIS emerged and what they did, many Muslims can't see where the Islamic rule is. ISIS had very sinister origins. They were all in an American camp during the Iraq War, up to 2008, 2009. Eventually, they all went on to establish ISIS in Iraq. Then eventually, they expanded into Syria. They expanded into Syria when the uprising was going on. And rather than attack the regime, they were attacking the rebel groups who weren't too far from overthrowing the regime. So you find again and again what ISIS did, it did many things which stopped the revolution, which got in the way of the revolution, rather than help it. So ISIS really is not viewed as an Islamic state or any form from amongst the Muslims. And in fact, it's one thing the Muslim world was unified on despite all the many differences they have.
Okay, so if you're saying that ISIS aren't the Islamic State and these countries, Turkey, Pakistan, Afghanistan, etc., they don't represent Islamic governance, there's a lot of questions about what is Islamic governance, what is the Khilafah. So if I could get your answers on some of these questions, just so that the audience has a picture of what the Khilafah would look like. So first of all, looking at governance, what would the governance of the Khilafah be?
Okay, so the Khilafah is a unique system of governance. It's based on Islamic texts. That's what makes it unique. And much of the details of the Khilafah system, they're taken from the actions of the Prophet ﷺ and the Sahaba after him. So the Khilafah, it executes the Islamic system of governance where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is sovereign, is a supreme reference, which is different to the West. And so the authority is with the people to appoint their ruler. So the Khilafah is also, and this is critical, is independent. It's an independent nation, and it carries the Islamic message to the world. So this is very different to the countries we have today. So the Khilafah has institutions, it has governors, it has departments, it has a judiciary, has a state treasury, and it has the Ummah's council as well. So what probably makes it unique is the fact that it's based upon the Quran and Sunnah. That's what's different from every other model out there. So if you look at democracy, if you look at what we had in terms of communism in the past, they were all based on a different view towards life. And that's what makes the Khilafah unique.
Now, you said that the people can choose, has the authority to choose who the Khalifa is. Who will be the Khalifa? And when you say they have the right to choose, would it be like an election?
So there's a very basic criteria for who the Khalifa is. And this comes from the Islamic text. And the Khalifa really has to be Muslim, has to be male, has to be mature, sane, just and capable. Anyone that fulfills that criteria can actually stand for the post. Unlike many of the Muslim nations today, Islam actually encourages a culture of meritocracy, whereby a person, regardless of their financial, political, family background, can legitimately assume leadership. So practically, the modern day, what that would mean is anyone who's working for Khilafah, as long as they meet these conditions, they can become the Khalifa. Obviously, because the Khilafah has not been around for 100 years, the obligation really is to establish it. Subsequent to that, there will potentially be elections. The Ummah needs to elect a ruler. And who has the popular will? There are many, many different ways we can identify that. Election is merely one way. So when we say the Ummah has the right to appoint a ruler, it is literally that. The Ummah appoint the ruler in order to implement the Islamic rules.
You said everyone will have the right to vote. Will women have the right to vote?
Yes, everyone has the right to vote. So everyone includes the whole society. The society consists of men and women. And women will play a central role. They have the right to appoint the ruler, just like any man as well.
That's very interesting, actually, because obviously in the UK, women didn't have the right to vote till the early 1900s, whilst you're saying in the Khilafah, they had the right to vote for over a millennia. But what role will women play in governance and in life in general?
So, I mean, just a caveat here, Yusuf, it's unfortunate we actually have to discuss this because, obviously, as you mentioned, for a long time, women had no rights across the world. And what you find is in the Muslim world, unfortunately, due to the lack of development and the chaos, you find that women are stuck in the middle. On the one hand, they want to be free. On the other hand, they don't really get to play a role. Now, Islam actually gave numerous rights and responsibilities to women at a time when no such rights and responsibilities existed. So Islam, it defined the role of a woman in society and it permitted her and encouraged her to play a role in public life. So a woman has every right to elect the ruler. She has every right to take positions in government. She can join and even establish political parties and she can partake in the political medium. The way Islam looks at it is everyone in society needs to play a role in upholding justice, in accounting the ruler, and in strengthening the state of society. So women play a central role in that. Islam doesn't differentiate between men and women when it actually comes to politics. Actually, it obliges them to partake in this amongst all the other responsibilities. And this is something that was established when Islam first came. And it's institutionalized. It's not something any individual person can physically change.
Okay, going back to the Khalifa himself and the Khilafah in general, what kind of government will this be? And would we be able to hold them to account? Because we find in many of the Muslim countries, you can't really say anything about the ruler. Would it be like that or would it be an accountable governance?
So the Khalifa will not have any luxury of being granted immunity from prosecution, like many of the rulers, unfortunately, that we have today across the Muslim world. The Khalifa is not able to dismiss or appoint judges based on political convenience at a time of investigation. Now, this is something the scholars throughout Islamic history have spent a lot of work researching, and there's a lot of literature on this. And what we find, Yusuf, Islam actually has built in and established rigorous measures of accountability. And probably the main one of this is we actually have a court in Islam called the Court of Unjust Acts. And this court deals with all issues and complaints to do with the people and the government. So that's the ruler, his governors, everyone. And although we call it the Court of Unjust Acts, it's really an agency. And the reason why I say that is, you know, in a court, until you don't bring a court case, there's nothing for the judge to do. There's nothing for a jury to do. This is not how this court works. This court is more like an agency. Its job is to constantly monitor, investigate anyone that's in a leadership position, including the ruler. So if you, for example, work for a tax office, if you work for CIA, you don't wait until cases come to you. Your job is to investigate everything that's going on at the time. And there's a specific institute in Islamic rule that's its job. Its job is to investigate the ruler, anybody he appoints, anybody in government. Good. So this is actually established in Islamic governance. So there's a permanent fixture that actually ensures this. Then Islam has made it an obligation to establish political parties. The job of political parties is to, one of them is to account the ruler as well. And Islam actually made it an individual obligation upon all Muslims to enjoin the good and forbid the evil. So that includes accounting the ruler, making sure the ruler is implementing Islam and holding him to account. So unlike today in the Muslim world where, you know, the monarchies we have no accountability, Islam actually has institutionalized accountability. So what we have today will become a thing of the past.
The Khilafah faced many challenges in history, and I can imagine it facing a number of challenges in the current day. Do you think it can actually work in the 21st century?
So, Yusuf, when we put this into perspective, what you see is the Khilafah in the past and in the future. It will be a society, and it was a society, that included both Muslims and non-Muslims, where Islam was applied on everyone. And as with any society, it's natural, Yusuf, that when your territories, your economy, and your population grow, you will interact with other people and other parts of the world. Now, in the past, this expansion it actually presents its own set of challenges that need to be addressed. So the Khilafah historically expanded over vast territories, and this brought with it many, many challenges. So we all know Islam originated in the deserts of Arabia. It expanded beyond the Himalayas into Central Asia. It expanded to the islands of Indonesia, all the way to the Mediterranean. Now, as different people came under Islamic authority, the Khilafah needed to amalgamate them. And as a result, the scholars of the past, they expanded and enriched the Islamic rules of citizenship, governance, taxation, and land rules. Now, although differences and tensions can arise in any set of relationships, they can be political, they can be economic. In the past, look, there were some instances of oppression and abuse, but in the long history of the Khilafah, this wasn't common. What we find, the norm is the Muslims lived with non-Muslims side by side. And when problems emerged, what you find is ijtihad was done and rules were extracted and put into place. Now, if you contrast this with the Muslim world today, what you find since 1924, Muslims have experimented with all sorts of things. They've experimented with communism. They've experimented with dictatorship. They've experimented with democracy. And what you find is the oppression today is worse than it was in the past. So in over 1,000 years of history, Yusuf, the Khilafah have a track record of tackling challenges rather than being consumed by them. Europe, on the other hand, Yusuf, if you look at them, they have a long history of war, exploitation, religious persecution, and genocide. So the question really we should be asking is, can Western liberal values really work in the 21st century?
Now, you said that they extract the rules. Could you tell me a bit more about that? Would it ultimately be a theocratic state?
No, so theocracies, Yusuf, at their heart, they believe that there is an individual or group of leaders who are infallible, and they have an exclusive right to interpret the word of God, where no one's allowed to challenge their interpretation. Now, although we believe as Muslims the prophethood was a theological position, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala appoints messengers, the Khilafah, on the other hand, is a human post, where the people appoint the ruler and they account him. So whilst the prophets were infallible, the leaders after them in the Khilafah, they are humans and they are held accountable. And this is what the Prophet taught us as Muslims. And that's what happened in history. So the Khilafah is not like Iran, who are a version of a theocratic state. Or on the other hand, they're not like Saudi Arabia, where you have a family who believe that they're above the law. It's a human post, and therefore you account them like any human. Humans can get things wrong.
Now, one thing I can't get my head around, Adnan, is how would a single person rule over such a large and vast amount of area, over 2 billion people? Like, I can't fathom that idea.
So that's actually a good question. So if we look, Yusuf, the Khalifa, the Khilafa, fundamentally is represented by one person, the Khalifa, at the top. But the Khilafa is as much as an institution as it is a person. The Khilafa comprises various departments, agencies, governance, a judiciary, a treasury, and many other organs that together form the institutions of the Khilafa. So today, Yusuf, if you look at the US, China, and India, they are continental-sized nations. They've got government structures and technology in place to manage their large territory and their huge population. Now, this was difficult in the past because due to vast distances and geography, it was difficult to manage the center with frontiers that were so far away. However, in the modern era, technology has made it easier to manage and govern a large territory. So when India has elections, Yusuf, they do it over a 3-4 month period. You've got America who has elections this year. They've obviously planned for them and they're using technology. Now, the Prophet ﷺ and the Khilafah Rashida, the first four Khulafa leaders, they demonstrated that you can delegate authority to assistants and governors. So that's how you govern it. It doesn't mean one person has to govern on his own. That person has assistants, he has governors. So with the use of technology and by delegation, you can rule over vast distances.
So it's not going to be like a federation?
No, so you've obviously got different models of governance based upon what's happened historically. So obviously with a federation, what you get is there's a level of autonomy between all the different territories. So if you look at the US, if you look at Pakistan, for example, these are federal states. So then you have the local governance. Sometimes you have tension between the center and these other territories. What you have in the Khilafah is one people, one nation, one territory. So rule is centralized, but the practical implementation is actually decentralized. So even if you look at China, for example, a vast country, and you've got Xi Jinping, you've got the Communist Party, when it actually comes to implementation, you find over 80%, some research shows, that China's actually ruled decentralized rather than from the center. So from the center, you make policies that are necessary at a macro level. But when it comes to most people, what you find is you need local leadership and local governors to deal with their issues, which may be different even within the same country. So now it won't be a federal state. It's one unitary state. But in terms of implementation and practicality, that can be decentralized.
Okay, Adnan, what will the role of the army be?
So the role of the army under the Khilafah fundamentally is to defend the Islamic territories and support the spread of Islam. When it comes to governance and the economy, this is what the state leads. This is not where the army is. So the Khalifa is appointed on behalf of the Muslims to lead them. Military personnel, they receive salaries and they're considered employees of the state who execute their policies. So they're not involved in governance and the management of the economy. This obviously significantly differs from what we see today. We see in places like Pakistan, Egypt, in the past in Turkey, where the army effectively is the rulers as well. So the role of the army, I mean, this is only possible because of the last 100 years, the lack of governance, and also through Western support. You see military rulers, military dictators playing very, very large role, even being the ruler. This is not how Islam sees it. The army has a role. Their role is to defend and to spread Islam. When it comes to governance and actual internal ruling, the army plays no role in that.
Okay, looking at the economy, and I know this is quite a big topic in and of itself, how would the Khilafah organize its economic system? Would it be a capitalist model? Would it be a socialist model?
That's a good question, Yusuf, because since the end of the Soviet Union, really capitalism and capitalist economics has become the dominant system. If you are not capitalist, then you are backwards and you have no role to actually play. I think it's important, Yusuf, is we define what is the capitalist economic system. Now, any economic system, Yusuf, is trying to answer some basic questions. It's trying to answer what are human needs, because it needs to satisfy them. It needs to determine what is the economic problem and how it will solve it and how it plans to distribute wealth. So you find any system, whether it's Islamic, capitalist or communist, it addresses these particular questions. So if we look at the capitalist economic system, it believes that human needs are largely material and the individual's pursuit of his own self-interest, it will lead to economic activity. And they believe through freedom of ownership, through being allowed to own anything and the free market, this is how people acquire wealth and this is how you distribute wealth as well. So free markets based on freedom of ownership, that determines the economy. Now, that's very different to how Islam views it. Islam has its own position on human needs, on the economic problem and on wealth distribution. So as a result, the Khilafah will not have a capitalist economic system, but it will have an Islamic economic system.
I'm not too sure about that, because do you think it will be able to compete? I mean, if we look at capitalism, it's had a very successful economic track record. In fact, even China has had to move away from their communist economic system and adopt more of a capitalist hybrid sort of system. Will the Khilafah be able to compete?
So capitalism really has claimed universal victory after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. However, just 3 decades later, capitalist nations are facing various economic problems that can no longer be ignored. So capitalism definitely has succeeded in creating vast wealth. But experts now acknowledge, Yusuf, that capitalism's biggest failure is the fact that it's not done this in any equitable fashion. So the Western world, where capitalism originated, has the worst wealth distribution statistics. And many in the West can actually see the system rigged against them. You know, many people, you hear them say they believe that the system serves the 1% who possess most of the world. So we should really acknowledge the achievements of capitalism without being selective. So to give an example, Yusuf, if we remove from the history of capitalism, if we remove colonialism and imperialism, it begs the question, where would the West be today? What raw material would Europe have used to build their economies, their industries, and start the Industrial Revolution? We can't ignore the fact that capitalism's success is built upon genocide, murder, plunder, and enslavement in much of the world. So the British Empire, where industrialization first happened, if you take away their imperial adventure in India, would the Industrial Revolution really happen? Because the raping of India is how they funded the Industrial Revolution. So yes, they've got lots of wealth, no doubt, although that's in the hands of just 1%. But you'd find a lot of the wealth, a lot of the materials in origin came from their colonies. Take that away, it'll be a very, very different picture today. So I think liberals have to be careful when they say questions like their superiority or how successful they've been. A lot of their success is built upon throwing under the bus the rest of the world.
Okay, so now tell me some of the key features of this economic system, because I don't think many people will understand.
So the Islamic economic system, Yusuf, is based upon guaranteeing the basic needs of people. So this is food, clothing, shelter, security, education, and health. And this is achieved through clearly defining public, private, and state ownership. So unlike the West, who chop and change what is public and what is private in Islam, this is clearly defined. So you find, for example, Yusuf, any resource which is necessary for society to exist, such as water, gas, electricity, these cannot generally be privately owned. These are public property. So these are owned by the people as a whole and administered by the state for them. So in the UK, Yusuf, we've had a lot of problems over the last few years of energy prices, of companies making lots of profits whilst people are struggling to heat their homes. In the Islamic economic system, this is a public property. This is something not owned by individuals for profit. It's owned by the people as a whole and administered by the state. The other thing about Islamic economics, Yusuf, is person-centric rather than wealth-centric. So what that means is wealth is seen as a means to satisfying one's need, not an end in itself. So what you find in the West is those people who own most of the wealth have a bigger say over the politics of the country and the world. So every year when we have the Davos Summit, you find Oxfam, they've done a lot of research on this, where they find that a lot of the wealth is actually owned by a few individuals. And they've even concluded, because the whole economy is based upon wealth, so whoever has the wealth has a bigger say. Islam doesn't actually view the economy like that. What Islam views wealth as a means to an end. It doesn't view it as an end in itself. Then finally, the Islamic economic system has a detailed framework for wealth distribution. So what you find is there are many, in fact, most of the Islamic economic system is actually about how to distribute wealth, how to ensure wealth keeps circulating, how to ensure people get access to wealth. So it's completely opposite to the capitalist system, which is more focused on economic growth. The economy has to grow. Who's taking part in that? Wealth distribution is just left to the market. People are just going to take as much wealth as they can. And obviously, the powerful get more of it. So Islam is a complete opposite to that.
So how would the Khilafah deal with things like poverty and inflation?
Poverty, Yusuf, it exists in the Muslim world due to various factors, such as inflation, foreign interference, insufficient development, debt. Fundamentally, it exists due to the failure of our rulers, really, to create any sustainable economy. So that's why you find, Yusuf, most of the problems, the economic problems across the Muslim world, they're actually man-made. You find that how is it that there's mineral wealth in these countries, but the masses are living in poverty? That's only possible because the resources are not being used to satisfy the needs of the people. So the way the Khilafah deals with this is you build an economy around a real economy, not around a Western-style parallel financial economy where you have a large financial sector, but the agriculture and industry is very small. The Khilafah would have a secure and stable monetary policy with gold and silver as the standard for money. So this would deal with inflation. The Khilafah would remove indirect and direct forms of taxation, and it will have a taxation system that focuses on wealth rather than income. It will abolish interest. You see, interest rates are going through the roof at the moment. This will help in dealing with poverty. And as I mentioned before, Islam has quite detailed rules on state intervention, and they call this public property. So Islam has some very Islamic-specific rules and regulations to deal with poverty.
Would the Khilafah have its own currency? Would it actually look into cryptocurrencies?
Yes. So when it comes to money, when it comes to prices, Islam has actually guided us to a unit. And if we look at the time of the Prophet, when it came to prices, when it came to fines, when it came to assessments, all of this was done in gold and silver. And gold and silver used to have been money for over 4,000 years. People have more confidence in gold and silver today than their own fiat currency. So yes, Islam will have its own currency, and this will be based on gold and silver. So whether you physically trade in gold and silver coins, or whether you have paper, which is represented by gold and silver, this is something the Khalifa will have to decide. So you can use cryptocurrency as well. Crypto is just a digital form of currency. But again, whatever the digital currency is, it needs to be physically based on gold and silver as well.
How will the Khilafah actually deal with creating jobs?
So at the moment, Yusuf, if you look across the Muslim world, you know, most of our countries, they're not built upon their strengths and their advantages. You find that they're dominated by a few rulers and their families and their cronies, or they're dominated by Western corporations. What we also find, Yusuf, is a lot of our countries, they were created using artificial borders. And what this does is, rather than it allows different regions to take advantage and have a big market, they are artificially separated, and this causes many, many issues. So really, the way the Khilafah is going to create jobs is it's going to prioritize industrialization and self-sufficiency, and this is required for you to become independent. And the Khilafah will do what many countries did in the past to develop, is you build infrastructure. And to build infrastructure, you have to build your heavy industry. So if you build your roads, if you build your towns, if you build heavy industry, this is what leads to economic developments. This is how the US, Germany, Japan and China all developed, and that's how they're creating jobs as well.
You mentioned about foreign companies. Would the Khilafah actually allow foreign investment?
So Yusuf, the problem with foreign investment or even foreign aid is it's seldom given from motives of pure altruism. What you find is aid is usually given because it's a tool, it's a colonial tool to control an economy or to open a market to their companies. So although I think $2.3 trillion has been given to Africa since World War II, Africa is no better today, it's actually worse off. So I think it's important we understand that foreign investment in aid doesn't lead to development of an economy. If you look at the US, if you look at China, look at Germany, they didn't develop because they got foreign investment and aid. What you find is they implemented policies, they established industries which made them independent. If you look at the Middle East and North Africa, Yusuf, they make around $500 billion every year from their oil exports. So the reality, the Muslim world doesn't actually need foreign investment or aid. It had the resources, it just needs to make use of them.
How will the Khilafah actually fund itself? What would be its main revenue?
So the Khilafah, like any system, Yusuf, it has its own taxation system. And the Islamic taxation system, very interesting, Yusuf, is primarily based on wealth rather than income. So things like income tax, general sales taxes, VAT, all of this will disappear. It's a much more simpler tax system, not the mind-boggling systems we have across the world today where people just don't understand them. And the other thing we've got to keep in mind, Yusuf, the Muslim world is full of resources, you know, oil, gas, gold, you name it. So there's more than sufficient resources really to fund the Khilafah. Unfortunately, this wealth today is just used by our rulers or used by their cronies, and for the people who just really don't see the benefits.
Another question that I had was about key industries within the Islamic State. Would the Khilafah actually try to nationalize these industries?
So no, Islam actually has clear positions on public, private and state property. So we're going to keep in mind, so nationalism is a very Western thing. When the free market caused wealth misdistribution and it caused mass poverty, nationalism was brought in order to try and save the system. So this is a very Western concept. In Islam, ownership is clearly defined, and Islamic rules when it comes to ownership is based upon the nature of the utility. So if the utility is needed for people to survive, you know, electricity, gas, these sort of things, then this is public property. If it's not needed, then individuals can own this. So no, we won't need to nationalize key industries because Islam has clearly defined what can and can't be owned by individuals and the state.
I know a lot of Muslims would be interested in this. So obviously in Islam, there's lots of different schools of thought. Which school of thought or madhab will the Khilafah be?
So yeah, it's a good question, Yusuf. The Khilafah, Yusuf, is not a madhab per se. I know a lot of people look at it like that, but the Khilafah actually is the overall leadership of the Muslims. It's not a madhab per se. As an institution, the Khilafah has the power to adopt from the Islamic texts, and it needs to adopt all the rules necessary for the running of the state. So the Sharia, it provides a broad framework that addresses the economy, governance, social relations, development, and foreign relations. And the Khalifa will need to adopt from these to solve all the societal issues. Now, the ruler, the Khalif, may choose to adopt his own opinions, do his own ijtihad if he's a scholar. He could also adopt from existing opinions or other schools of thought if he wants to. So the Khalifa, he's required to apply Islam and adopt from the Islamic texts. Therefore, he's free to adopt from a madhab or derive his own opinions as well. So the Khilafah itself isn't a madhab. However, the Khalif can adopt his own opinions or adopt from others as well. So that's why you're not going to have that this is a Mu'tazila state. This is a Wahhabi state. This is a Shia state. Because the state is for all Muslims.
I can't actually see that working. There's so many differences with these schools of thoughts that even on simple things look such as how to pray and what is halal to eat or not, there are differences and they sometimes blow over. How will the Khilafah deal with differences that are on a societal level?
The problem, Yusuf, in the Muslim lands is there are many artificial differences, such as borders, national flag, national anthem, the nationalism, and this creates a problem. So you find that differences don't exist over the beliefs. So, for example, the fact that Muslims pray, the fact that they fast, there are the differences over this. But the differences are over artificial minor actions and opinions. Now, problems arise when there's no mechanism or legitimate authority to deal with these differences, particularly when these relate to society or public life. And this is what usually leads to confusion and conflict. So what the Muslim world needs is to be the unifying force. There's 52 nation states in the world that are Muslims, but they can't actually create this at the moment. So the implementation of Islam, when it's actually applied, that will actually act as a strong unifying factor, and that will transcend all these artificial differences of, you know, border, the national flags and things like that. Unfortunately, you said the Muslim rulers play on such differences to keep the Ummah divided rather than unifying the Ummah. And one of the reasons, Yusuf, or one of the hikmah, the wisdom behind having a khalif, having a ruler, is that his job is to adopt and unify the Ummah and solve these disputes. Unfortunately, what our rulers do today is they use these differences for their personal advantages, and that's what makes these problems even worse.
Now, Adal, let's talk about some of the minorities within the Khilafah. How will the Khilafah deal with the transgender people, with homosexuality?
So yes, these are very practical questions today. So when we look at transgender people, look, the Khilafah implements Islam. So it views all citizens as male and female, as Islam requires. The Khilafah will apply Islam on society based upon the gender of the people at the time, irrespective of what took place before the arrival of the Khilafah. Now, this is really a problem, Yusuf, of the West creation. Because of their views on postmodernism, because of their views on liberalism, they view gender just like identity. You can change your identity, you can change your gender like your identity as well. So that's why, rather than your gender being based on biological fact, for them, gender is whatever you believe it is. So you can chop and change your gender, or you can even be fluid. That's not how Islam views it. So when the Khilafah emerges, it will deal with people on what the gender is at that particular time. Now, I know there's a lot of talk about equality, protecting minorities, but these are all politically motivated discussions. These are all politically motivated debates. These have nothing to do with actually taking care of people's needs. You mentioned homosexuality as well. Everyone knows this, Muslim, non-Muslim. Islam restricts sexual relations between men and women and within the institution of marriage. Therefore, Islam doesn't permit sexual activity between the same genders. And if anyone's found guilty and proven in court, they will be punished.
I think the important thing to note here is that it's any sexual activity outside of marriage, it would be punished. And sometimes there's a bit of a skew that it's just about homosexuality.
Yeah, absolutely. Islam, the social system, which is how men and women interact, is based fundamentally upon marriage. Between men and women, marrying, having children, society expanding. Homosexuality doesn't fit into that. That's always been Islamic view.
What about the Qadianis? Obviously, they believe themselves to be Muslim, but the Muslim community generally does not see them to be part of their community.
So, yes. So, Yusuf, you know, Islam was revealed to be implemented on society. Society consists of Muslims and non-Muslims. And Islam provides a framework for governance and everything else to do with society and how you apply this upon the citizens. So the Ahmadiyya movement, or the Qadianis, as we know, they were founded by Mirza Ghulam Ahmed near the end of the 19th century. He was from a small town in North India. And he emerged at a time in support of the British Empire occupation of India. And he claimed, obviously, he was a prophet, and he claimed he was a successor to the prophet. And this actually led to many splits within his own group as well. he was a big supporter of the British occupation of India, and that's why it's quite interesting the claims he made. Now, today's Qadianis, Yusuf, who are descendants of Mirza Ghulam and the original Qadianis, they effectively are born to non-Muslim parents. If you're born to non-Muslim parents, you're just a non-Muslim. So the normal rules for non-Muslims and their rights will apply upon Qadianis. So Yusuf, I think we've got to keep in mind the Khilafah's job or the role of Islamic governance is to take care of people's needs and fulfill them. So people have, you know, they need to earn, they need to eat, they need to be secure, they want to have relationships. The Khilafah is there to ensure this takes place and it has a system for this. So from that perspective, Yusuf, what colour you are, what family you're from, what your beliefs are quite irrelevant. When I go to a shop to purchase something, the beliefs of the person is irrelevant. If I want to buy a can of Coke, as an example, what your beliefs are, how you believe you should worship, how many gods you believe they are, is actually irrelevant. So when it actually comes to applying Islam on people, really, Islam is colourless. It doesn't see colour. It doesn't see creed. What it sees is people and their needs need to be taken care of. Yes, Islam recognises that people do have different beliefs and these are generally protected when it comes to, you know, their belief about the world and God or how they want to worship. But I think it's important here because we could probably come up with a long list of people who have different beliefs. How do you deal with them? The overarching view is humans have the same needs and the Islamic system is geared towards addressing these. And these don't change. You know, everyone needs to eat. Doesn't matter what belief you have. Everybody needs security. Everybody needs to survive. You know, what color you are actually makes no difference. So Islam has actually addressed this. So it's addressed every different type of minority that exists today and that probably will exist in the future as well. And that's a very unique way Islam looks at
it. So Adnan, what you're saying is that there will be such a thing as minority rights, ultimately.
Yeah, so minorities as a term, Yusuf, was invented by the West. So for them, minorities should be grateful that they are recognized, that they're in their countries, and there's certain obligation they have towards the state. So you find when it comes to France, it doesn't recognize groups, what it sees as individuals. When it comes to UK, for example, it recognizes your group. So, you know, you have Asian minorities, you have the Caribbean community of minorities. Islam is a bit different. Islam views minorities as or non-Muslim as dhimmis, and this dhimmi means covenant. It means an agreement. It means an obligation upon the state, upon these people. So this means the Khilafah is duty-bound and accountable for upholding their rights. What are their rights? Well, their rights are they can have their beliefs, they can practice them, their marriage and divorces are protected, they have obviously a right to worship, they can have their food, they can dress in whatever religious clothing they have. And the Islamic State is duty-bound. It's an obligation upon them, not a privilege, not a side thing. It's actually an obligation upon them to actually protect it. So we do have rights for minorities, but obviously minority means quite a particular thing because it's emerged from the West.
That's a very interesting point you mentioned about they have the right to dress however their religion pleases. Is that still applied to women? Because obviously in Islam, there is a very, what some people would call a very strict dress code for women.
So that's quite interesting. In the modern world, the Islamic dress code does look strict. Because obviously they believe in individual freedom. So you can wear whatever you want. And, you know, in the 60s, the mini skirt was seen as liberation. And I think for some reason today, the less you wear, the more liberated you are. I think it's important to realize that up until about 100 years ago, dressing conservatively, wearing a veil, was quite normal across the world. You see pictures of the royal family in the UK or across Europe 100 years ago. You look at Christian women, you find that generally they should dress modestly. What we have today is really a modern thing, which has only emerged over the last 100 years or so. Now, the Khilafah, Yusuf, it will only enforce an attire for women that is decisive from the Islamic text. And according to the Islamic texts, Muslim women in public life, they are required to cover their entire body except for their hands and face. Now, beyond this, there's scholarly difference of opinion and the Khilafah won't really get involved in that. When it comes to non-Muslim women, they can generally wear what they want within the framework of the Sharia. Now, what that exactly is, the Khalif will have to adopt at the time. But the Khalif won't prescribe a particular type of clothing for them. Now, this begs a question because for a lot of people, they will look at this and they see this as the state interfering in the private life of individuals. But when you're outside on the road, that is not private life, that is public life. And it's the job of the state to regulate public life. So where the West have a different view towards this, you know, liberal societies have a view, it's all about the individual. In the public sphere, this is the realm where the ruler is. Now, Yusuf, if we were having this discussion 100 years ago, this wouldn't even be a question. But everyone dressed modestly. What we have today really is what's evolved over the last 100 years because of liberalism.
Okay, let's move on to the foreign policy. What is the foreign policy of the Khilafah? Would it try to propagate its view? Would it be expansionist?
So the Khilafah's view towards the world is no different to what the European view is, and it's no different to what we saw during the Cold War, which is the Khilafah is a particular system. It is a system where it will be propagated and carried to the world. And every country that had a system in the past has done that. Currently, you said we have an interesting scenario that despite democracy and capitalism and liberal values dominating the global order, people have had enough of that order. People believe the order doesn't actually work for them. People believe we need a different order today. So when it comes to spreading Islam, Yusuf, this is seen as a political action. So the strength of your economy, your military, your technological development, how you take care of society, this plays a crucial role in attracting other nations. And Islam will do this no different to the way the West does it. When the West invaded Iraq to democratize it, what was it doing? When it invaded Afghanistan and it occupied it for 20 years and it put a regime in place, what was it doing? When the Soviet Union collapsed and Eastern Europe was invited to join NATO and the European Union, what were they doing? They were expanding. So this is normal. This is what everyone's done throughout history, and Islam will do the same thing.
So how would the Khilafah actually deal with powers such as the US or such as China, who is actively oppressing Muslims?
So Yusuf, when we look at the US today, America's power is largely a mirage. The Taliban, they defeat the US after 2 decades of occupation in Afghanistan. You find, Yusuf, if you go back to 2008, when the global economic crisis happened, the Arab world wrote a check of $220 billion bailing out the US during the crisis. What you find, Yusuf, is all the ACE cars today, the mineral resources, strategic location, they were all in the Muslim lands. Unfortunately, the Muslim rulers just don't utilize them. The main thing is most of the rulers in the Muslim world are lackeys for America. So they need to be removed. You remove them, you remove American bases, there's very little America can do. The advantages and the power America has in much of the world is because it has rulers that are loyal to it in place and it has access to military bases. You take these two things away, the situation changes. Regarding China, it's unfortunate, Yusuf. The Muslim rulers today have really let the Muslims of China down, the Uyghur Muslims. They're too busy looking at China's economy and economic deals rather than the oppressed people. China, Yusuf, is also always had a difficult relationship with other people. It's always had problems with people on its periphery. The Khilafah and its relations with China, it's got several options to deal with the oppression of Uyghur Muslims. And unlike the Muslim rulers today, the Khilafah views the Ummah of China as its people. And therefore, relations with China would include resolving the Xinjiang issue. And I think finally, so we've got to keep in mind, China is desperate for security on its land borders on the west of China. On the west of China, it's surrounded by Muslim nations, Central Asia, South Asia. So any security agreement the Khilafah makes with China has to include dealing with the oppression of the Uyghur Muslims.
How would the Khilafah deal with foreign interference within its borders, especially with the likes of these European colonial powers?
For foreign interference, Yusuf, it can be removed if you eliminate the tools foreign nations use to interfere across the Muslim world. So you find the key tools the global power use, Yusuf, are agent rulers, economic aid, military bases, these sort of things. Each of these, if you deconstruct them and you remove them, the means to interfere also disappear as well. And you know, most of our rulers and the economic and military aid, it really just served the global powers and it served the individual rulers. It doesn't help the people. So you remove foreign interference use by removing the tools that are utilized to interfere.
What about the existing rulers in the Muslim world? What would happen to them?
So when the Khilafah emerges, obviously the Khilafah will expand and unify the Muslim world. The role of the Muslim rulers come to an end. To be honest with you, Yusuf, the Muslim rulers are largely illegitimate and they're useless anyway. They're there to plunder their nation and they're there to serve themselves. So to be honest with you, getting rid of them will probably be a good thing.
How would the state deal with Iran and the Shia population?
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. The clerical regime in Iran is about 40 plus years old now. And the Iranian people have had enough of them. You see mass demonstrations against them. You saw the death of Mahsa Amini a year and a half ago. And people saw what the clerical regime is really about. You find yourself, there were massive protests in 2020, 2021, and code was used to clamp down on these protests. In Iran, people have had enough of the clerical regime. The clerical regime, they don't see as representing them. They see it as corrupt. So when the Khilafah comes, to be honest with you, they'll actually be grateful that the clerical regime's been removed and overthrown. And I think a lot of the Shia issues, Yusuf, there's a lot of research, Yusuf, that shows the Shia issue arose at the early part of Islam. And then for most of the time, up until the 19th century, it was dormant. There wasn't even any major issues. Most of the Shia today in the Middle East, they live side by side with Sunni Muslims. What you find in the last 100 years, it's really being used by the West. And then obviously Iran, that was established in the name of Shia Islam, they used that and it causes factionalism amongst the Ummah. But as I mentioned, Yusuf, the Iranian clerical regime has no credibility left. And really, if we view Shias as another school of thought, Islam already has multiple schools of thought. The Shia can just be viewed as another school of thought. And as I mentioned before, what people in Iran want is their needs taken care of. They want the economy to work. They want access to energy. They want to have jobs. They want to live in security. They want to be able to appoint their ruler. And the Khilafah is there to do this. So it's not really an issue of the Shia. They're humans. And actually, their needs and their challenges are no different to people in Pakistan, to people in Turkey, and to people in Africa.
What about Israel? What will be the Khilafah's position on this Zionist entity?
So the view of Muslims, of Palestinians, and many other people is Palestine is occupied land where Muslims, Jews, and Christians resided for over a millennia side by side. And then the Zionist movement emerged. And then obviously what happened from then onwards, you know, we all know. So for several decades now, Zionists have expanded their occupation and they've been provided with financial and military support and still covered by the West as well as the Muslim rulers. They have a slow motion expulsion ongoing. And really what they've established in Palestine is an apartheid system that discriminates and oppresses the Palestinian people. So really the Khilafah will work to reverse this occupation and uproot the apartheid system. That will be its view.
So you're saying that the Khilafah will dismantle this Zionist apartheid state. But what would happen to the people themselves? Would the Khilafah then expel Zionists and Jews?
No, so the Khilafah will not carry out an expulsion like the Zionists did to the Palestinian people, like they're still actually doing. Jews and Christians have always resided alongside Muslims in Palestine and outside. This is for over a millennia, and this setup actually worked. If you look, Yusuf, Islam came to Palestine in 620, and up until 1917, it ruled all that period, minus 88 years during the Crusades. During that period, Muslim, Jews, Christian lived side by side. There were no problems. The problem that we have today emerged with the emergence of the Zionist movement. And the reason why we have a problem is because their agenda was to expel and ethnically cleanse the indigenous people that were there. So no, the Muslims will not do what they've actually done to us. What they will do, and this contradicts Islam as well. Islam doesn't permit us to expel people. Islam requires us to apply Islam over them and take care of their actual needs. So the apartheid system needs to be uprooted and removed. So you could argue that's regime change. Now, the people who today reside in Palestine, Muslims, Jews and Christians, or many, many Jews, obviously, they can live there. Muslims have lived side by side with these Jews. Those Palestinians who lost their homes, Yusuf, and lost their land, if they can prove their ownership, then rightfully these will be returned to them. This is justice, and this will be dealt with through the courts. The last thing, Yusuf, here is Palestinians have never called for the expulsion or the genocide of the Jews. What they have called for is their right to reside in Palestine and live in peace and security in their own homes. The Zionists are the ones who came, expelled, and took over their territory. And actually, they've been making many statements where they still want to continue doing this. So, no, the Muslim, the Khilafah, will not do what the Zionists did to the Palestinians.
Will the Khilafah adhere to the existing international order and treaties and obligations under that order.
So when the Khilafat established Yusuf, the existing agreements and treaties, they're going to need to be reviewed. Those that don't contradict Islam can continue. And those that do contradict Islam, they're going to have to be renegotiated or they're going to have to come to an end. The problem fundamentally is Yusuf, many of these agreements, they're made by rulers who personally benefit from them, whilst many other agreements bring no tangible benefit to the country or the Ummah or the Muslim people or the citizens, and they largely serve the West. So international treaties, Yusuf, we have to keep in mind, they're there to serve the interests of the Western powers. They're not there to serve the people. So these need to be reviewed, and the ones that don't serve the people, they have to come to an end.
What about the current global liberal order? Will the Khilafah abide by it, or does it have its own agenda?
So the global liberal order, Yusuf, at the moment is struggling for survival. Donald Trump wants to rip it all apart. It was set up after World War II to serve the US and the West. Even today, Yusuf, China and Russia are also challenging it as well. So what this shows you, it's actually time for a new order, but one that serves all people, not just colonial interests.
During the Cold War, there was the USSR and the US, they were competing on things like the space war, they were competing in sports and things like that. Would the Khilafah actually participate in these things?
Yes, space research, Yusuf, and exploration is a vital tool for defending life on Earth in the modern world, and it's actually a measure of technological progress. Satellites, probably a key part of any space program, they're widely used for military security-related issues and even civilian issues. So the Khilafah will need to develop a space program in order to engage in these particular areas. For the Khilafah, though, Yusuf, the space program is about how it can serve the Ummah on Earth. It's not about deep space travel. It's not about is aliens out there. It's not about how far we can get to another universe. It's about life on Earth. That's how we actually view it. In terms of sports tournaments, you know, Olympics, World Cups, sports are permitted in Islam. Therefore, engaging in them is also permitted. Sending a Khilafah team or Dar al-Islam team to participate for the Khilafah, this is really going to depend upon the priorities of the state. Now, because of the World Cup in Qatar, people see this as a way of soft power. The thing is, soft power is fine when your hard power works. So if you look at America and the Soviet Union, as you mentioned, they engage in political struggle, in showing how their systems work, in solving economic issues, in organizing society. Then on top of that, you had, you know, entertainment and sport and these sort of things. What we can't do is we look at sports when you haven't solved your societal issue. The way you attract people is you solve societal issues, you develop the economy, people's needs are being fulfilled, you make poverty history. Then you do all this stuff. What you don't do is you have a great football team, but you can't feed your people. You send people into space, but you don't have enough toilets for people. This is why, you know, you're going to have a massive contradiction. So the way you promote yourself is by solving societal issues.
Final question for you, Adnan. Many people will look at the world and they just can't see how the Khilafah will come about and how it would function in the modern era. What would you say to anyone, particularly non-Muslims, who are listening to this podcast? What's your message for them?
Okay, so this is it's a normal question, Yusuf. It's actually a very, very normal, very, very common question. And what I would say, look, there's a couple of things we've got to keep in mind. If we were in the 1500s, Yusuf, nobody would have seen the rise of the West. The rest were living in the Dark Ages. And if you had said the West is going to rise now, the West is going to revive, the West is going to dominate the world, people would have laughed at you. People couldn't see it. If we were alive in the 1700s, Yusuf, people would have laughed if you said the US would be the superpower in the world. The America was just a few colonies. It wasn't even established yet. In 1776, it came about. If you were to say it was going to dominate the North American continent, people would have laughed at you. People just couldn't see it. In the 1800s, where was Russia? Russia was this poor, barren country, and it had very little resources. In 1990, Yusuf, where was China? China was a poor country. But what you find, Yusuf, is these countries, these territories, they changed their circumstances when people didn't believe it was possible. So what's normal in history, Yusuf, is the impossible becomes the possible. There are 2 billion people in the world, Yusuf, that believe in Islam. And Islam can only be implemented by the establishment of its political system. That makes the rise of the Khilafah inevitable in many ways and very, very possible. So that's what I would say to that. For non-Muslim, Yusuf, I think it's important we put the current political context in Wuda. Many people look, especially in the West, this is the region that dominates the world. Many people see that their politics is rigged. They see politicians serve the 1%. And they see an economic system that's created more food banks than McDonald's branch. The utopia that many people in the West were promised has actually given them a nightmare. That's actually outlined in the Hunger Games trilogy, if you ever get around to watching it. Really, people are looking for alternatives. And it's time that they do look at alternatives. And there's 2 billion people in the world that actually do have an alternative. And I think that's the context we're going to look at this.
Thank you for your time today, Adnan. Just to remind the audience, Geopolity will be publishing a booklet, 100 Years, 100 Questions and Answers, on the 3rd of March. So please keep your eye out for it. If you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolity.com, all one word. You can also learn more on other issues by accessing our website. You'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening. Thank you.